The opinions and commentary expressed in the following presentation do not reflect the views of this station, the Economic Club of Indiana, or the Economic Club's agents or sponsors. Support for the Economic Club of Indiana is provided by the Lumina Foundation, with a goal to increase the percentage of Americans with high-quality degrees and credentials to 60% by the year 2025, focused on ensuring an accessible, responsive, and accountable higher education system.
Welcome to the Economic Club of Indiana. Today's presentation features Roger Penske, Chairman of Penske Corporation, in conversation with Mark Miles, President and CEO of Holman & Company, to talk about 50 years of Team Penske.
So a couple seasons back, we had the great privilege of having our very good friend Mark Miles address the Economic Club. Mark is an extraordinary business person, civic leader, and we are so pleased to have Mark in the city of Indianapolis. And Mark is going to play a very special role today, which is he is going to serve as the inquisitor of our special guest, Roger Penske. The name Penske is synonymous with success. I have brought with me Wednesday's Indianapolis Star headline, which says, Team Penske dominating IndyCar. This headline could have been written 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, 20 years ago. Roger Penske started auto racing as a driver. After a successful career in road racing, he retired in 1965 to focus on his business career and purchased a Philadelphia area Chevrolet dealership. Team Penske began in 1966 at the 24 Hours of Daytona. Most well known for open wheel racing, Penske Racing has participated in several disciplines of motorsports over its 50-year existence, including open wheel, stock car, and sports car racing. Over 80 drivers, among them names like Andretti, Allison, Wallace, Castroneves, Sullivan, and Mears, have driven for Roger Penske. As a car owner, Roger Penske has won the Indianapolis 500 16 times. No other car owner has won more than 4 times. Team Penske has also claimed wins at the Daytona 500, Formula One, 24 hours at Daytona, and 12 hours at Sebring. With 29 national championships in motorsports, the most recent one being last weekend at Sonoma, California with Simon Pagenaud, claiming the IndyCar championship, Team Penske is one of the most successful teams in all of professional sports. But Roger Penske has also built an extraordinary business outside of racing. Today, Penske Corporation manages revenue of greater than $26 billion and employs more than 53,000 people globally with a diversified portfolio of transportation service companies from manufacturing to retail to logistics to racing. So it is my great pleasure to welcome up our good friend Mark Miles as well as racing legend Roger Penske.
Thank you, Matt, for that introduction and for the invitation for Roger to be here. First, a word about our feelings about the Economics Club. This is a precious asset for our community. Great content that's just so important, I think, to the community. So we're pleased to be here. And based on this audience, I think, Roger, it's in pretty good hands, doing a great job. So, Roger, I can say with complete integrity that one of the highlights of my now nearly 4 years at the Holman Company has been the opportunity to get to know Roger Penske and the people in his organization. He is, as Jim Morris would say, extraordinary in every sense. And I can tell you that I know that his success and his people's success is based on his own personal character and his personal leadership style. So for me, it's been a real treat, Roger, to
thank you
to get to know you a little bit, and we welcome you here today.
Well, I didn't know, Mark, whether I should come with a suit and tie or my earphones, whether I would be received better. But obviously, Indianapolis, means a lot to me. And when Mark asked me if I would come for the Economic Club, It's a great honor to meet many of you, and obviously to come here and compete. But this is a special place, you know, in my life and my family. So thank you very much.
Matt did a great job in his introduction, but he could have said more about Roger as a racer. There's at least some folklore, Roger, that when you were at Lehigh University, on the occasional Friday, you'd go by the infirmary and feign illness so you could get an extra day at the track.
That's right. Even those days.
Can't outlive that. Right. This is Friday, so we're glad you're well enough to be here today.
Thank you.
But Roger was incredibly successful as a driver at that early age, was named as Sports Illustrated as the SCCA Driver of the Year, raced a couple even Formula One races, lots of national championships. So I know you've been asked this question before, but you obviously love that, and yet you made a decision to kind of go cold turkey and hang up the helmet and get into business. Was that a tough call? How did you make that call at the time?
Well, as you know, I competed in racing when I was at Lehigh, and you know, loved the sport, and had a chance to come to Indianapolis and take my driver's test in 1965, and because I was working for Alcoa at that time as a sales engineer, I couldn't get a month off in those days, and as it was a month to get off, it was. And when you're making $425 a month, you better be at the job. So I gave up the opportunity to drive and take my test here at Indianapolis. And Mario Andretti took the test with Clint Bronner and Jim McGee. Probably don't know that. So, and of course, Mario's had a fantastic career. And as part of that, Mark, I was then had moved from Alcoa, worked for a Chevrolet dealer in Philadelphia, and I had the opportunity. When I went to work, I said I'd like to buy the business, and I got to the point where we were negotiating, and I went to Chevrolet, and they said to me, "We don't want race drivers as dealers." Jim Rathman, in fact, who some of you might know that name from the past, he had become a dealer after he had finished racing. So that was point number one. And the one most important point was that I went to my dad, and we always had this agreement that if I wanted something, if I could earn half, he'd help me with the other half. And I think that's what I've tried to do with my grandkids today. But I went to him and I said, I need $50,000 to make this transaction, make it happen. And so I remember getting in the car driving from Cleveland to Pittsburgh, where he had worked for a company there. He had retired, and he took $50,000 out of his savings account, and he said, look, if you lose this, I'll go back to work. So That was all I needed, you know, personally, to not let my dad down, and I guess that's where we really started. You know, was the business was as a Chevrolet dealer in Philadelphia back in 65. So that was something that you know, I look at it, and the most important thing, having been a driver and understanding the pressure and what you needed to know in those days to be successful, you know, that's kind of a vault that I have, a safe of that knowledge, helps me when I'm dealing with the different drivers and different personalities that many of you see out at the track, because trust me, they're all different. One's on Dancing with the Stars one day, another one's from Colombia, another one from France, so you can imagine it's the United Nations in our garage from time to time. But That was very important to me, and the fact that I could take automobile racing, Mark, and become, it became a common thread, you know, through our business. And, you know, we have businesses in 9 countries and 4 continents now. So this brand that we built really came about, I would have to say, a lot of it through the success we had here at Indianapolis, because when you think about the notoriety of a 3-hour race and your cars are leading that race, obviously you've shown you're competitive, you've got capability from a strategy standpoint, and the drive and teamwork. These are things that have kind of been the bedrock of our business, and to me, that helped us you know, build the company. And on top of that, the opportunity to partner, and people say, well, how did you build this business? I probably built it more on partners, whether it was Chevrolet at one point, we bought Detroit Diesel from General Motors, We've done work with Daimler, with Ford, with Toyota. In each one of these cases, we tried to tie the business to business, and that has really been key. And the access has been because we've been successful at Indianapolis. So trust me, I can say that without my dad taking me here in 1951 when Lee Wallard won, I might not be sitting here on the stage today. I might be doing something else. So I owe this group here a lot. Thank you.
Yeah, things worked out. You know, your businesses are largely closely held, and so I know you're private about them, but I think it'd be helpful if you'd elaborate a little bit on the businesses you're in. This is after our The Economics Club, and I just wanted to give you credit for one thing. The belief around the motorsports industry, back to your business-to-business point, is that you really invented the business-to-business model of sports sponsorship. Most sports sponsors get involved based on a consumer proposition, but you have really made that common thread work, and it's really the lifeblood now of, I think, IndyCar racing. So if you will, tell us a little bit more about the businesses generally.
Well, as I said, you know, we compete in geography around the world, and we really have two primary businesses. One, our public company, Penske Auto Group, that's on the New York Stock Exchange. You know, we'll do 430,000 new and used cars in 2016. That means one every 1.2 minutes. So as we sit here today, I hope that we're ringing those up as we go forward. So I see Terry Leeds here today, so he's probably taking a few of those away from us over in the north, over on the north side. But that business, and when we look at it, we've made the decision to initially, and we really bought a small business, a New York Stock Exchange company in '99. It was doing about $900 million, and our business will do $20 billion in automotive this year when you think about it now. The number's big. Obviously, the margins are small. I won't let you know that if you're doing business with us, so just be sure. But I think the decision, Mark, that I made was that we were going to look at premium luxury. We were going to look at volume foreign. And so when you look at our mix, 72% of our business is premium luxury. And volume foreign is 24, and the big three is only 4%. So we missed all of this bankruptcy in our business. We were very fortunate as we went through this. And one thing that I've tried to do is be very vertical. So, you know, our financing, our floor plans, we've always stayed, you know, with the manufacturers, because it seems as this markets go up and down, the manufacturers have they're in the same rainstorm that you are, so it's worked well. And from a people perspective, I found it's a terrific business to be able to grow people. And we have people that come in. I've got women today that are running many of our stores that maybe started as receptionists, but they had the right energy, they had the right interest, and we really try to promote. For anyone talking with Matt about it earlier, that 95% of our people that move up in the company are ones that started with a company, and we're, you know, turnover is a bad word in our company. On the other hand, we don't have a business where nobody fails. Remember that. You know, we do take the bottom group out, and we do that on the race team. We do it, you know, always. But so we have the auto group, which has been quite successful for us from the standpoint. But to show you the impact, we have a big part of our businesses in the UK, and our stock price went from $38 a share the day before Brexit. It went to $29. In 48 hours. So I found out about foreign exchange, obviously, because the pound went from $1.50 to $1.30, but we've clawed back, and the stock almost was at 50 here in the last couple of weeks. So, you know, you can return. On the other hand, a business that we've been quite successful in, you've seen our yellow trucks, I'm sure, you know, in the Indianapolis market. You know, I started out with a small Hertz franchise in Reading and Allentown and Pottsville back in 1969. We had 300 units. And today, that business has 240,000 units in operation and with about 900 maintenance locations in the U.S. side alone. And you think about the mix of those, we have 80,000 tractors, so the big trucks you see on the road. And this is a business that's about service, you know, and to me, in our logistics piece, we handle all inbound raw materials to all the Ford plants in the U.S. Whirlpool, all the inbound raw materials, the finished goods, and we run about 21 million square feet of warehouse. So these two businesses, they're transportation-oriented, and that's a private company. GE was my partner for a number of years. I spent 20 years on General Electric's board of directors, so I went through the Welch area, and of course, ML today, who is the chairman, and it really gave me, it was like going to graduate school to be on these boards and to understand, you know, how to act and how to run your business. And so when I look at the two businesses, Mark, it's people and it's human capital is the difference. It's amazing. You seem to be able to get the money, but can you get the operators? And that's our biggest. Every day as we grow, are we stretching our people? When we decide to go to three cars and four cars at the Speedway, I didn't know whether that was going to impact us negatively. Could we have the same level of perfection across, you know, all four cars? And I'd have to say we're finishing 1, 2, 3 in the championship this year. We were a little bit soft last year. We should have won the championship, but obviously we didn't. But this year we performed. So we set targets for our people. We have budgets, and we're rigorous on those. And it's just something you set it in at the beginning of the year, and we talk to you at the end of the year. You know, we are doing remediation all the time. And I said earlier today that we probably have at least 2 human resource specialists for every 250 people. Because the biggest issue we find in our business is communication. People just don't communicate. They run it from the 10th floor. And you've got to be down there where your people are. Every job in our company on the auto side gets advertised at every store. If we have any opening across the country, you can walk in to it and we have those available, because we want to see people wanting those jobs. And many times, it's just the fact that you acknowledge they put their hand up, it gives you some value with your team. And I think that my interest in cars as a young kid, and certainly the racing, kind of, as I said, the common thread, Mark, has made a difference. So, you know, those are basically our two businesses. And then I have my golf game and my fishing trip is racing.
Well, that decision to go from 2 to 4 worked out pretty well for you, I'd say. He not only finished 1, 2, 3 in the championship for the year, 1, 2, 3, and 4 in qualifying at Sonoma, and 1 and 3 in the race, so he sort of ran the table in Sonoma. Well, I asked him to cool it a little bit because he's got to have somebody to beat, and he looked at me like I had 3 heads. Sure, that's going to happen. So, Roger, your success is just unbelievable, and but I'm going to ask a different question about that. What was the biggest, for lack of the right word, failure? I mean, we all make mistakes, and it's about how you recover. What comes to mind?
Well, there's one on the business side, which Kmart was having trouble, and they came to me and said, look, we'd like to have you take over the Kmart stores across the U.S. And we said, wow, great. Goodyear gave us $30 million. Napa gave us money. The oil company gave us money. So this is a perfect scenario. Well, you know, after about 2.5 years, they went in bankruptcy, and they started closing stores. So, you know, our costs, our admin costs obviously went up, and we were at a point there that we were putting $5 million a month of equity back in the business. And I can tell you, it was a tough time at that point for us, but what could we do? Finally, this is a quick story. I called the CEO. I said, look, we've got to do something here. You're closing stores. My rent's too high. So, and they were in bankruptcy, so they sent one of these specialists over, and he said, let me see your balance sheet. And so I gave it to him on Monday, and they came back and said, where's the rent liability on your balance sheet for all these stores? Well, right then I knew I was in a real traffic jam. So I got a hold of my leasing guys. We had 800 stores at that point. I lined up 800 tractor trailers, and I went to Kmart and I said, I'm going to shut down on Friday. And I was going to take the tractor trailers and anything that wasn't bolted to the floor, we were going to take out. Of course, in bankruptcy, they went to Chicago and got a stay order. Said, no, but you can't do that. So I said, let's just say we're going to do inventory. So we papered the windows, and within a week, we worked it out, and we closed that down. But that was a very tough process for us. And the good news is, you know, when you've got partners that you have in other business, we paid everybody back. It took us a while, but we did. And probably the one that got the most notoriety and really made me a much better person was probably in 95. In 94, as you know, we came here with a Mercedes engine. We sat on the pole. We led, I think, all but two laps, and with Al Unser winning. And the next year, we didn't qualify for the race. And I remember walking down the pit lane with Al and Emerson Fittipaldi. I can see it today. You know, in those days, 100,000 people there on qualification day. You're walking with your two drivers back to your garage, and you didn't make it. But that made our team much stronger, and certainly Mark, for me personally, it was a tough day. But when we did come back, you know, we had to split there for a while. We won that race 3 years in a row, so it shows you, you make yourself, you really understand it. And I think personally, this sport that we're in, it's a lot of emotion. And I think there's people in the racing business, and then there's racers, and the ones that are close to the sport. These guys work day and night. I mean, there's no eight hours, no time clock. A guy driving the truck or doing, and you know, we'll fly parts in. I mean, we'll have people welding stuff at night, and think just changing because we found something, and it's an amazing effort. But it's given us the motivation within our company to talk about excellence and performance. And to me, that failure, those two are different. Fortunately, knock on wood, we haven't had many lately. So I don't know whether being here today, what's going to happen next year when I go back to the speedway, since we've had such a good year.
Well, I'm sure it will not repeat itself. Change gears, sorry, a little bit. I don't know exactly how many, but I don't think you miss an IndyCar race. And Roger's role, among others, at a race on a race weekend is to be in the pit stand for Elio's car number 3, which really means you're running the race for him, you're calling the race for him. First of all, I marvel at your weekend schedule, not just with IndyCar, but with NASCAR. Absolutely amazing commitment and love for it, obviously. But tell us, what do you do in there? What are the skill sets what do you have to do to make those calls? And what's, obviously you drove, but what's the background, what's the pressure, what's the experience like in a pit stand?
Well, I think the first thing we do is we set the weekend up. We'll get quite a briefing that's sent out to from the engineering department on really what we're going to do on Elio's car from minute one all the way through each practice, you know, what changes we're going to make, and then to see where we are. And so, of course, I'm up to date on the briefings. We always, have, after every single practice, you probably don't know this, we have a trailer. And in it, there's a table, and the four drivers sit facing each other on one side, and the engineers sit on the other side. So they're actually talking about what they found in their car, and we have telemetry now. When I make a change, they make a change on the 3 car. The 22 knows it right away, and they can see lap times. So with the telematics today, we can do quite a bit. So there's that kind of communication, and what I do, I sit in those meetings probably for 15 minutes to get the early part of the discussion, and then I'm busy, you know, with sponsors and other people to try to be sure from a business standpoint. And then on race day after warm-up, I bring the engineer and three or four, and the chief mechanic or four of them on my car only, into a small group discussion about strategy. And Tim will do that. So we really have four separate meetings. And we found out we don't have any team orders. Now, if there was a came down to the last and we needed one guy to help each, it probably would, but fortunately that's not been the case. We don't have team orders, so each one, we're racing each other. I mean, we are running hard against each other. So we set our strategy. There's a lot of today, you've seen the red tire, which is a softer tire. And when do you put them on? How long do you run them? When do you take them off? So I'm on the radio with Elio, and we have an intercom system amongst the key guys on the stand and the chief mechanic. I also have a management channel that I can talk to the other three cars, because I might talk to Cindric and say, hey, I think I'm going to come in. Why don't you do the opposite? Because many times you'll see one will come in and one will stay out. And we do that on purpose in order to give us a competitive advantage in some cases. So, Mark, it's I love it. I mean, to me, I'm like a caddy. You follow me. I want to be there. I want to see the shots.
Yeah.
So it's really something that if I couldn't be involved, I don't know. I wouldn't be very happy sitting up in the suite, I don't think.
Well, you're amazing at it. You've made it clear throughout your career, I think, how special the Indianapolis 500-mile race is to you. I'm also going to ask you a question about Indianapolis and Detroit, but maybe start by just telling folks how you feel about the 500 and why it means what it does to you.
Well, you know, many of you have been to this race many, many years. I came in 51, I think I told you, with my dad, and to see the track, how it's changed, and the iconic nature and just worldwide, you know, drivers want to win this race. It's amazing. I mean, Tony Stewart and other people wanted NASCAR, but they wanted to win this Indy 500, and when you have 350 people here, or 350,000, it was amazing. And I had the honor of driving the pace car this year. And I've always seen the cars go by on this first lap, this by the pit, but I've never had a chance to see what do they look like. And when I sat in the pace car and we're doing these laps and I looked in the mirror, it looked like there were three fighter jets, you know, just ready to take off behind me. I mean, you've probably maybe seen it, but I think the race has grown in popularity. We've gone through some ups and downs, as all businesses do. But today, it's the number one race in the world, and I use it every day as a brand value, as a tool, Mark, to grow our business. And we attract a lot of people that want to come to work for us. And these are people at the lower level. It's amazing how many. And I was talking to someone today about interns. We probably have 40 or 50 or 60 interns every year. People that we road test them. To be honest with you. In the summer to come and work for us and see, because those are people that we can, whether it's engineering, whether it's in the sales side or, you know, IT and the things that we're dealing with today. But the 500 has been special, and there's no question that the 100th running was one that I couldn't believe. And probably the thing that I always remember and it's so meaningful is when the military come down the pit lane in those trucks. It is so great to see that we acknowledge the sport, acknowledges the people that are serving for our country, you know, as they do. I had a chance to go to the PVA, the Paralyzed Veterans, two nights ago in Washington, and just listen to the stories of these people that have these injuries and yet they're coming back. But I think that makes it, you know, it's Memorial Day, and where is there a bigger celebration? So it's a pretty special place.
It's going to get bigger.
You can make that happen.
So I did a little math, and I think you probably spent about 3 years of your life in Indianapolis in May installments for the most part, and you're passionate about your community of Detroit. Maybe talk a little bit about your observations about what used to be Indiana Place not that many years ago and Detroit. And there are a lot of parallels, including, I think, the Super Bowl.
Well, I ran the Super Bowl in 2006 in Detroit, and that was really a kickstart in our city. And, you know, we went through bankruptcy, obviously, but, you know, today places that I boarded up and painted, in fact, in 2006, now are lofts and apartments, and it's hard to get one downtown. We've got 20,000 jobs. We had only 50% of the lights on in our city. Now we have 95. I mean, there's just been so much good happening, and young people wanting to live in our city. And to me, the attraction of jobs and people have made a difference. And I parallel that to Indianapolis, having been here for so many years. We never went downtown much. But to see the downtown, how vibrant it is today, and see the hotels that have been, I mean, Marriott, some of these really, really big commitments from a financial perspective. The convention center here, I mean, is a terrific impact for bringing in events from the outside. And remember, the economic benefit that the 500 brings in, and then individually, when you can have a vibrant city, makes a huge difference. And you know, when I think about the state of Indiana and having a $2.5 or $3 billion, you know, surplus, it's because cities like this are able to manage their own fiscal capability, where some people don't. But I remember the wood garages out at the Speedway. Thank you for giving us nice garages. My only disappointment is the Speedway Motel is gone, because I always like to be able to know I didn't have to worry about traffic. So it's been a big change, but I take my hat off to the people here in the business community and others who have made a commitment downtown, and you can see it. This from a logistics standpoint, you know, we use, you know, this market in Indianapolis is a key point for us in logistics. And, you know, we've seen up north, up by the airport, it's really been a huge impact out there. And I see that, you know, even being greater in the future. So, you know, the technology, tech people moving in here, and to me, the wage rates are realistic. You know, I understand that real estate taxes and things like this are fairly level. So someone's doing the right job. And the point that I want to make is the fact that the Holman George Company, from the very beginning, and I go back to Tony, I know I've got a picture of myself and Tony. I mean, there was a real commitment here. And I think that the family has done a great job. And Mark, you know, certainly with your stewardship now, is, you know, we see a very bright future.
And we see it in Detroit now, getting up there for your race in Belle Isle. It's you can, every year you see marked progress. So another thing that I've been in, it's been a pleasure for me, is to get to know your family a little bit. And they come around for any number of the races, from your wife to your sons and daughter. Somehow you keep this schedule and look over this empire almost from a business perspective, but you're close. How do you do it? Talk a little. I mean, none of us have any balance in our lives, but somehow you have a great family relationship.
Well, I've got a wife of 43 years, so that's a pretty good start, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. So,
and, you know, five children, four boys and a daughter. My older boys were involved with me through the auto business, but they've gone out. I've said, look, there's no chair available for you to sit in my office right now. You've got to go do it on your own, in which they have. And my other one boy's in the media business, another one's in financial services. But my daughter, obviously, who's my favorite, the youngest, she has six children, 11 and under. So anybody that understands what that's, she's probably the best operator in the family.
Yeah.
But what I'll tell you, the great thing is that with 13 grandchildren, Mark, you know, we meet at Christmas time as a family. And we meet in the month of August, 7 or 8 days. If you miss the picture, you're going to be out. So everybody shows up. So and they all love the racing. They've all been involved. And I think that in one way or another, but yeah, I'm very fortunate we're healthy, and we're fortunate. I watch a lot of hockey when the racing season's over, when I can. I go up and see these kids play hockey and stuff, which is takes me back to my older guys. Terrific.
I'll bet. So we can go in executive session. I can excuse myself if it's more appropriate, but comment a little bit honestly about how you feel like where IndyCar is now and the Speedway, knowing that you got a group of talented management folks from the Speedway over here and they're looking for a compliment. How are we doing? What's the trajectory from your perspective?
Well, having, you know, been involved in Indy racing under USAC, the IRL, you know, we had to split. We were away for a few years. But as I see the sport today, we've never had a better on-track product. And when you think about the race this year, sure, it was won by a fuel strategy. Ironically, the engineer in that car used to work for us. Just to, he loved doing that. He loved to see it beat us, I'll tell you. But when you think about the competition, the number of passes, so the product... Mark, I think that the rules and what you've been able to put together, at least on the big tracks, has been excellent. The fact that we're getting data equity and we're going back to Toronto and we're going to Detroit, we're going to Mid-Ohio and Elkhart Lake and these places, Watkins Glen, you know, some typical tracks, is going to make this a much better series, because you just can't announce a race and 3 months later go there, because you need to get the community involved, as we've done in Detroit. So I would say the on-track product is good, the consistency of our dates, and I take my hat off from the standpoint, officiating in sports, as you know, is always, when you're on this side, my side, you're never happy with the results. But I'd say the way you have structured the stewards now with the three drivers and then Dan Davis is kind of the captain, we've had more clarity, you know, more decisions, more realistic time from the standpoint of interface. And I don't really think we had really any big issues that created a negative impact, you know, on our image of the sport, which I think is key. And with that, and then Jay Fry, I'd have to shout out for Jay, who came in to be one of your key guys, and certainly that's been a real plus. So I'd give the from the on track, I'd give it a sure an A. I think we're a good solid B as we get our schedule where it needs to be, and the officiating is certainly an A. And I think that as we look at the Speedway and the money that's been spent here in the last year and the opportunity, for young people, I came when I was 14, and we young people have a chance to access. I think more access is important. And the racing, our racing is probably the right length, because in NASCAR, people are complaining 4 hours or 3 hours. They turn it on, and they wait and turn it back on. I think we've got a lot of action, which has made a difference. And the commitment by the cities that you're involved in, I think, is excellent. So keep up doing the good work. So I can't give it all A's, but I got to push you a little bit here, don't we?
They'd kick us out if you weren't candid. So we got a couple questions from the audience. The first is moving back toward our economic club roots a little bit. And basically, I think the question's asking, given your perspective on business, from a U.S. policy point of view, to improve the business climate. What comes to mind as key opportunities?
Well, I think we're dealing with over-regulation. I mean, I would just say that hopefully at some point in the government that it seems that everything since the financial crisis, the over-regulation in the finance industry, the EPA, lots of these things are going to have to be adjusted because they really have an impact on what we do. Certainly as we look at the automobile industry, the requirements for them as we go forward in 2025 for a 55 mile per gallon fleet average, you know, that's going to drive electric vehicles, autonomous vehicles. And, you know, we hear about all these autonomous vehicles. Remember right now there's people sitting in these cars that are running in Pittsburgh, and I'm not sure I'm going to be around when there's no steering wheel and you jump in the back seat. And We look at that in the truck side of our business, and we'll see platooning, which will be maybe a truck. There'll be three trucks running down I-80 or I-95, and the one in the center might have no driver. But I don't think you're going to see big trucks today in the future running without drivers because of the catastrophic type accidents and the legal community that we live in. And that's another thing. I think the legal community today is just brutal from the standpoint of our business. So, we deal with it in regulations. The auto industry, certainly when you run as many trucks as we have, we have to be very careful from a safety standpoint, from an emission. So I see, the pooling of vehicles where today the car you drove to the office today might 2 hours of use. We're going to be seeing there'll be a lot more pooling of cars, and I see that as a place that we can jump in with our locations. And instead of having 240,000 trucks, we might have 480,000 cars, and I have four or five of you. Some of you know on the airplanes you can have a NetJets where you can own a piece of a car, and then you schedule it right off your iPhone in the car. You can have the car. And we think that's kind of where things are going to go from our standpoint. But the economics, I think it's over. We just over-regulated personally.
I think I'd rather be the real driver in the back of that three-truck caravan than the guy in front, at least for a while.
I think that's right.
A related question from the group relates to any predictions about the future of electric cars in racing.
Well, it's interesting. My son Jay, there's 22 cars that are running in the electric vehicle series. It's an international series. They run all over the world. And interesting, they have two cars because the cars can only run for about 20 minutes. They got to bring it in and get another car. So the battery life today with the power you need to have the performance. But I think that there'll be hybrid technology, which they're using in some of the long-distance races like at Le Mans. I think we'll see some of that. But I think right now, as long as there's internal combustion engines and You know, as we've seen today with direct injected motors, the fuel economy we can get and the better emissions, you're still going to have that. But you will have EVs. You'll have 25% of typically most manufacturers by the time we get to 2025 will be all electric, because they need that in order to meet the average fleet economy requirements by the government. So we're looking at that, and I guess that changes our model as a dealer. Think about it. We got electric motor, you follow me, you won't have the maintenance.
Right.
Now, if we get more utilization of the car because we're pooling, that creates more. That'll create maybe more maintenance, but you'll have regenerators in the brakes. So you're going to have a bunch of electricians now instead of guys rebuilding motors. So that's a real question. Maybe not for me in my lifetime, but as we go forward, how are we going to transition into that going forward? So there's some big questions for us.
Definitely. So we got a question that's, when will a woman win the Indy 500? But maybe we can broaden it just to talk about how you select drivers, what you look for. You talked about the United Nations in the trailer. And then what you think are the prospects for women in racing.
Well, Lynn St. James, Janet Guthrie, there's been some drivers, women who have done well. Danica, quite honestly, I was disappointed to see her not continue. They're special, the women that want to get into, especially in an Indy car. You know, we don't have power steering. The stock cars have power steering. But an Indy car, you got a steering wheel that's this big. And think about it, in some of the turns at Sonoma this weekend, the G-forces were 5 Gs, which says the car weighs 1,500 pounds with a downforce. With the wings, it weighs 7,500. And just to have the muscle capability, I think, and some of that is a tougher, probably, for a woman, unless she's been brought up in the cars and understands that. But we'd love to see a woman. In fact, I've talked to Danica a couple times. I think sometimes she'd like to come back, but she's been committed. There's some women, I don't know all the names, that have been quite successful in Europe. In the longer distance races, they've done quite well. But at the Speedway, they need to have it. I know Beth Peretta was going to have an all women's team here this year, and then just couldn't get it all together. And would have been very interesting. It would have been great to see that. But I'm assuming that's going to happen. And with the sport as popular, and we need diversity across all areas, of the sport. And you know that as well as I do. So I hope we'll see that soon.
Yeah. So this question is about, I'll frame it for you, I think. You've got diverse businesses, and are obviously substantial. So you got to have, you've talked about human capital, but you got to have the right leader at the top of each, even though you don't mind being hands-on yourself where it makes sense. How do you pick at the top? Is there a process inside the company? You talked about promoting from within. I'm trying to make this question relevant to you. Basically, I think it's, how do you select your very top people?
Well, what I've done to build the business is looked at underperforming and undervalued. You know, we bought the Hertz Truck Division back in 1982, and I run those businesses myself for probably 4 or 5 or 6 years. And then as I do that, you start to build a capable team, and then you pick one of those people who have the DNA of the company and have the experience. So all of my key guys have come up from the inside. When we bought Detroit Diesel, it's interesting. It was Detroit Diesel Allison. Allison here was, and they split it. And we bought that business back in '88. And I came in the first day, and the gentleman who had run that business, Lud Cosey, I wanted him to stay. And he said, "Well, you can have my office." I said, "No, I'm moving in with you." So I moved in. I put my desk next to his desk like this, and we worked side by side. You know, we talk about this open environment today. We worked side by side probably for almost a year. And he said to me one day, he said, "You make excuses to call customers." I said, "That's the problem with this damn place. Nobody is selling. You're selling too many people inside selling each other." So I like to be inside these businesses. We worked with the UAW there and had great success. But we typically, Mark, I spend the time, same thing at the leasing company, and we build these businesses up and pick from inside. And I don't know, knock on wood, a case where we've lost a key guy and we haven't been able to replace. If we did, we replace it with an internal candidate. And I think as a board of directors, if you're on a board and you have to go outside, I think about these big companies. That's where Mary Barra is such a star in my world, where she came up through the plant and now head of General Motors. But how many of these companies do you read day in and day out where they got to go outside and get a new CEO or a new CFO? I mean, these are not jobs that are special. These are management jobs. It's not technical. It's management. And what I've tried to do, same thing on the race team. I mean, everybody on that team that has a job has come up from, whether they were a truck driver, they were washing the cars, they were polishing wheels. And I think that, and that's pretty basic, but that's how you, that's, I think that's how you build a good company.
By the way, Larry Dewey at Allison's now is doing great. They're his whole team and taking an important role in this community. Maybe our last question. I think we're running out of time. I might do a little coaching in the way we frame it. The question is, as written, was should the 500 continue to be televised live in Indianapolis? And I know you know that that was possible because we basically couldn't sell any more tickets, and that made it important for us to be able to make it live. But so with that little bit of coaching, you might go ahead and take
a swing. I think that you're going to see a nice bounce from the 100 year, because that was a special special time. Next year, I'm the interest. Look, as a promoter, and you're a promoter, and we need to be sure that we fill the seats and we show the that this business is gaining, this race is continuing to have the level of success, and you have that option in your contract to open it up. And I would hope that that's a high class problem to happen, that you got to open it up to the local community. But there's no question that was great last year, which you could open it up for the folks in the market. But we want to see you folks at the track. How's that?
Well, thank you so much, Mark and Roger. What a wonderful discussion, and it was a great privilege and honor to have you here today.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And yes, today's program will be rebroadcast on WFYI Public Radio 90.1 on Saturday, October 8th, and is also available very shortly for download at WFYI.org. On October 25th, our speaker will be Jeff Harrison, President and CEO of Citizens Energy Group. Jeff is a remarkable corporate leader and a wonderful member of this community who's deeply committed to Indianapolis. You will enjoy him greatly, so please purchase your tickets. You can do that at economicclubofindiana.com. Have a wonderful day. We'll see you next month. Thank you so much.
Thank you for joining us for today's presentation, part of the 2016-2017 Economic Club of Indiana Speaker Series. Join us next month at this time for a speech from Jeffrey Harrison, President and CEO of Citizens Energy Group. You can find more information online at economicclubofindiana.com. The Economic Club of Indiana is a production of WFYI Public Media in Indianapolis for Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.